Previously on Beta.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Will it be bachelor number one, bachelor number two, or bachelor number three?
It's settled down number two, yes. It was up at number one for a while, and it got dizzy, and it felt guilty at number one. It's a Midwestern book, and we don't feel right on top.
Yeah, you shouldn't be up there.
No.
Make a spectacle of yourself.
That's right.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author and filmmaker Nancy Jo Sales tells us how dating apps have transformed romance into a dystopia.
There's a huge problem with dating apps and sexual assault that is so under-discussed.
Also, comedian and radio host Tom Sharpling on his memoir, which features some nice and not-so-nice memories.
It's very, very liberating to have a creative platform that can just take on whatever shape I want it to take on.
And an installment of our recurring series on cult filmmakers. Today, it's the godfather of indie films, Jim Jarmusch. But first...
Hey, we're broadcasting here! We're broadcasting here!
In the 1960s, a movie with an X rating was pretty much doomed to a death sentence, much less Academy acclaim. But in 1969, Midnight Cowboy, starring Dustin Hoffman and John Voight, went from an obscure production that no one wanted to touch to 7 Oscar nominations and into film lore. Midnight Cowboy was a daring and different kind of film. Based on James Herlihy's novel of the same name, the movie focuses on Joe Buck, who moves from Texas to New York City to seek his fortune as a male prostitute. Buck meets a disabled con man named Ratso Rizzo. The film's director, John Schlesinger, wasn't afraid to push boundaries by exploring such subjects as homosexuality, prostitution, and sexual assault. Author Glenn Frankel has carved out a unique niche for himself with his film biographies. Glenn's latest book is called Shooting Midnight Cowboy: Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. Glenn says he likes to pick the films he writes about based on how they define their era. Few offer a better chance to do that than the gritty and pioneering Midnight Cowboy.
Midnight Cowboy was filmed in 1968. It came out in 1969. That's an era rich in conflict, anxiety, cultural change. And it just, obviously, it was going to be rich, complicated terrain. And from then on, I was there.
John Schlesinger directed Midnight Cowboy. Why did he want to make this movie?
Well, John Schlesinger has had some real success in the UK, where he was born and raised, first as a documentary filmmaker, trained on BBC television, and then makes some of these sort of black and white, gritty, interesting kitchen sink movies, as they were called at the time, and has some success. And his biggest success then comes when he moves his camera down to London and does this sort of semi-satirical, critical movie called Darling. It's a great success. It wins for Julie Christie the Academy Award for Best Actress. And what is her first starring role? He's a hot commodity. And so the studios in Hollywood are interested in him, and he's interested in coming to the States. He was looking for a movie, though, looking for a story about New York and a story about outsiders coming to New York as he is coming to New York as an outsider. So he gloms on to Midnight Cowboy. It's not exactly anyone's favorite idea for a first movie in the States. A lot of the studios have read the novel and rejected it. He hooks on with an independent New York producer named Jerry Hellman. Jerry doesn't love the novel either, but he really wants to work with Schlesinger. And he's willing to meet Schlesinger halfway and to do this kind of thing. He knows New York. And so the two of them get together and set out to find a studio. And they end up with United Artists, a very small but unconventional studio from that era. And for a very minimal budget, United Artists is willing to do this film. So John gets to make the film he wants to make, but he's got very little money and he's got to rely on people he hardly knows to get this thing organized and started.
A couple of writers wrote screenplays that Schlesinger and producer Jerry Hellman were not happy with, but then along came this screenwriter named Waldo Salt, who wrote a screenplay that they were happy with. What was it about Waldo's script that made it work?
I think Waldo understood what was at the heart of the novel, this relationship between these true troubled guys. Joe Buck, this lonely outsider from Texas, handsome guy who buys himself a cowboy outfit and gets on the Greyhound and comes to New York thinking he's going to become a male hustler and using the cowboy trope, as you will, as his, you know, sexual invitation.
Oh, hell, I'm a hustler. You didn't know that?
And at the same time, Ratso Rizzo, this sort of disabled con man from the Bronx with a pulmonary condition and, you know, one of life's true losers.
But I mean, you're picking up freight on the street right there. That's nowhere. I mean, you got to get yourself some kind of management.
They both are really two of life's, of God's lonely men, if you will. And Waldo got that. Waldo understood the heart of that. Waldo had also spent a lot of time in New York. He's a screenwriter who had been blacklisted in the early 50s for his membership in the Communist Party. He's a lifelong alcoholic. He's a troubled guy. He and Schlesinger and Jerry Hellman, the producer, spend months. They rent a little cottage out on the beach in Malibu and work on this thing. And there's a lot of conflicts between them. But Waldo is the guy who can give them the heart of what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Schlesinger originally didn't want either John Voight or Dustin Hoffman for the lead roles. Why not?
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? Because they're so wonderful in the movie, and he comes to understand that. But he didn't, you know, Dustin Hoffman is the first one who's offered up to him to play Ratso Rizzo. And Schlesinger has never seen Hoffman in his 10 years of working in, you know, in New York of, off Broadway, on small TV shows, that sort of thing. He thinks of Hoffman as Benjamin Braddock, this sort of clean cut, white bread young guy that he sees in The Graduate. He doesn't think he can play Ratso Rizzo. Also, Hoffman, The Graduate makes Hoffman a sort of overnight, not only an overnight movie star, but an overnight sort of counterculture icon, because The Graduate's such a successful sort of generation gap movie. It comes out in 67. And Schlesinger doesn't want a big movie star messing with his little movie. Hoffman convinces him, though, by basically dressing in a dirty raincoat, learning how to do the limp, meeting Schlesinger at midnight in the automat in Times Square, and then dragging him around Times Square for several hours and wearing down his resistance. And Schlesinger comes to realize that this guy isn't just a movie star. He's a character actor. He's a true actor. He didn't want Voight either. Voight had never been in a major movie. He didn't like Voight's sort of Dutch boy looks. In the novel, Joe Buck is a dark-haired, tall, handsome guy. Schlesinger was thinking of Michael Sarrazin, a French-Canadian actor who he'd met on the beach at Malibu while he was working on the script. And in fact, they do auditions on these guys, and they decide to sign Michael Sarrazin. But Sarrazin is already signed to another film company, which wants big money for them to use him. And remember, there's a very limited budget. They've given Dustin Hoffman a fair amount of money to come in it, and they simply don't have the money to pay Sarrazin. And meanwhile, a woman named Marion Doherty, who's the casting director in New York, who's helping these guys cast the movie, she believes Voight has the right sense of vulnerability and a little bit of violence in his soul, that he can play Joe Buck with all his weaknesses and his strengths, and she pushes hard for him. Later on, John Schlesinger admits in many interviews that he's so lucky to get these two guys. They're both New York-trained actors. They work together beautifully, and that he wasn't responsible for casting John Voight. It was Marion Doherty.
One of the most famous scenes in Midnight Cowboy was filmed at the corner of 6th Avenue and West 58th Street in New York City. Can you tell us about that scene?
Yeah, it's early on in the movie. Joe Buck's in town. He's had his first sort of unsuccessful tryst. He's basically a very vulnerable figure, and he meets this guy in a bar, Ratso Rizzo, who says, well, you know, I can help you become a successful male hustler. I can introduce you to friends who can get you started. And they're walking down the street talking, and Ratso's doing his line of, you know, his con man routine with Joe Buck, who looks like a good target. And they're crossing the crosswalk when suddenly a taxi cab comes into it, you know, trying to beat the light. Well, they're in the middle of the crosswalk, and Ratso slams his hand on the taxi cab, says,
I'm walking here.
It's a classic New York moment where he asserts himself. And Dustin Hoffman always told the story that this taxi cab was and driver in this, you know, breaking into the, trying to beat the light was not in the script. It was an improvised moment. It was a real cab with a real driver. And he made up those lines in reaction. He was going to say, we're making a movie here, but he catches himself and he stays in character. It's a famous line. It's probably the most famous line in the movie because it so epitomizes this New York attitude of pride and anger. Well, the problem is that 6 months before, in a draft script from December 1967, the taxi cab is coming through the crosswalk and Ratso is slamming his hand on the hood of the car. So there's a crew member driving the cab. The timing is perfectly timed for the cab to come into the crosswalk. What is improvised, though, or what isn't in the script, is the famous line, "I'm walking here, I'm walking here." In the script, he just, Ratso slams his hand down and flicks off the taxi driver, and that's it. So I think you can give Dustin Hoffman 3/4 of the credit, because it's the line that really is so famous and so enduring, and Dustin certainly improvised that, or at least made it up, you know, and it's not in the script. Schlesinger loved it. It becomes one of those iconic moments in the movie.
Most definitely. How did the song Everybody's Talking, performed by Harry Nilsson, end up on the soundtrack?
Among other things, Schlesinger brought in people, as I say, from outside, including a handsome young man who he'd met in L.A. called Michael Childers. Michael was 24 years old. He was a UCLA film student. Schlesinger sort of appointed Michael, a handsome young guy, to be his envoy, if you will, to the sort of lively arts world in New York, including the Andy Warhol crowd. He also assigns Michael to, you know, look at record albums and see what's out there that might be an interesting song. Again, this is after The Graduate, where Mike Nichols has used Simon and Garfunkel songs in a different way than we've ever seen in movies before. He's doing the songs repeatedly, using songs that aren't necessarily connected to the movie, but that resonate somehow. And so Michael comes across this rather obscure Harry Nilsson album called Aerial Ballet and a song called Everybody's Talking. It was written by a Greenwich Village folk singer named Fred Neil, but Harry turns it into a very lively pop song. It hasn't hit very big, but Schlesinger really likes the lyric and the sort of lively rhythm of the song and the lyric that goes,
"Everybody's talking at home. I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind."
It sort of sums up in his mind Joe Buck's vulnerability and the sort of enigmatic feel of Everybody's Talking, and the vulnerability that's in the song and the sense of solitude. He thinks it really gets you in the head of Joe Buck. He sticks with it, and it really, and he uses it 3 or 4 times in the course of the movie, and I think it really is the thing that ties the movie together. It's so memorable. It's one of the 3 or 4 things that really stand out about the movie.
Mm-hmm. Definitely ties the movie together, much like the rug in The Big Lebowski really ties the room together.
Exactly.
Yes. Can you talk about why Midnight Cowboy received an X rating and what problems that caused prior to the release of the film?
Hollywood had just moved from the old, what was called the production code system of censorship, to a rating system, which was actually designed to allow movie makers more leeway in making more adult, using more adult themes, making more complex movies. They were aiming for the younger sort of baby boomer audience. And Midnight Cowboy is one of the first movies rated, and it comes out with an X rating. And the myth is that this was the sort of prudish ratings board, you know, being scared by the sort of, well, rather tame sex scenes in Midnight Cowboy and by the gay sex scenes in Midnight Cowboy. The truth is something rather different, I found out. I interviewed someone who was on the ratings board at the time. The movie depicts both gay and straight sex, and the sex scenes, though there's no nudity, there's no romantic sex. These are transactional moments between a male hustler and his potential clients. And it made people uncomfortable. And at a time when homophobia, even in New York City, was sort of the standard operating procedure, and gay people were never, you know, depicted in movies except being very troubled and often, you know, committing suicide, you know, at some point in the movie. John Schlesinger was doing something, who was gay himself, was doing something much more complex. And so the head of United Artists, a guy named Arthur Krim, who was an important figure in New York, both in politics and in in fundraising, Arthur was uncomfortable with this, and he took it to a New York psychiatrist, an eminent psychiatrist, who confirmed that these gay sex scenes were something that young people shouldn't see, that young men, you know, might be influenced somehow to become gay themselves. They thought of homosexuality in that era, or at least the psychiatric priesthood that was so influential in New York, thought of homosexuality as sort of rather like COVID-19, a disease, an infectious disease. And so under the advice of this eminent psychiatrist, Arthur himself rated the movie X. He didn't tell anybody he did that. The movie was rated X, but in a sense, the X rating was a little bit of a come on to people like me. I mean, I'm an 18-year-old college student in New York at that time. The fact that the movie was rated X, the fact that it starred Dustin Hoffman, who I knew was suddenly a big, important, iconic figure due to The Graduate, those were the things that attracted me to see the movie. So it doesn't hurt the movie at first, but when the movie gets nominated for 7 Academy Awards, which surprised everyone, and gets wonderful reviews, and even starts doing well at the box office, which no one had expected, United Artists has a change of heart. And after it wins Best Picture, the only X-rated movie ever to be nominated and ever to win the Best Picture Oscar, United Artists comes back to the ratings board and asks to get an R. And the ratings board doesn't even think twice about it. They give the movie an R. It's rated down. But the legend is that this was something that maybe the ratings board asked them to take out a scene or a few seconds. It's not true. It's the same movie we saw that was X-rated is now an R, and that's the way it's come down to us today.
How has Midnight Cowboy influenced the movies that came after it?
Well, it is the opening movie of a sort of a decade of grittier New York movies. Movies like Dog Day Afternoon and Taxi Driver. It's very influential on those kinds of films. And the ultimate, Taxi Driver is really the ultimate dark New York film. And so the Midnight Cowboy is the first, and its success opens the door not only to these kinds of movie makers like Martin Scorsese, but also to movie stars who are following in Dustin Hoffman's footsteps. You begin to get Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Richard Dreyfuss, guys who never would have been movie stars in the 50s and 60s. They do not look like Cary Grant or Tab Hunter. It opens the door for them as well. So in that narrow sense, but I think in a bigger sense, the barrier breaking about sexuality, about what a movie can be about, is where Midnight Cowboy really breaks the ground. It is the first of its kind. And movies that follow in that line, like The Last Picture Show and some other films, follow in its footsteps. It's funny, John isn't in the pantheon of great sort of new Hollywood directors like Scorsese, Robert Altman, Peter Bogdanovich. There are a lot of reasons for that, I think. Part of the reason, frankly, is I think because John was an exuberant gay man. And that didn't fit the mold that Hollywood was looking for in that sense. But nonetheless, I think his best films, and Midnight Cowboy, in my opinion, is his very best film, hold up with anything else that comes out of that sort of lively, fertile area.
Mm. Glenn Frankel, thank you very much for joining us. It was great talking to you, and congratulations on shooting Midnight Cowboy. It's a wonderful book.
Well, Doug, thanks for having me on.
Glenn Frankel is the author of Shooting Midnight Cowboy: Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.
They tend to reinforce racism, racial preferences in dating, which I think is just another form of racism. It's just like a nice way of saying racism.
Author Nancy Jo Sales joins us to talk about dating apps. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
We evolved in the context of small groups where, say, ranging from 50 to 150 individuals. In small group living with limited geographical mobility, you would have only encountered perhaps a few dozen potential mates in your entire lifetime. So what's weird is that we take this, small group mating psychology where the number of potential mates is very limited, and transplant it to the modern world where we have thousands and thousands of potential mates that we can keep swiping through. And it triggers this short-term mating psychology in a way that never would have been triggered ancestrally.
That's a clip from the 2018 documentary, Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age. It's directed by Nancy Jo Sales. She's an award-winning journalist and the New York Times best-selling author of American Girls, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. It's safe to say that Nancy Jo has become one of the foremost authorities on dating in our digital age. Now she's out with her follow-up, Nothing Personal, My Secret Life in the Dating App Inferno. It details her personal journey through the emotional gauntlet of dating apps. She joins us now to talk about how these apps are rewiring our cultural approach to sex and dating. For example, Nancy estimates that some adult users spend 10 hours a week on dating apps. She says this isn't a healthy search for love, it's an addiction.
It's designed to be addictive almost immediately when you start using the app. And I did an interview with Jonathan Bedeen, who's one of the co-founders of Tinder, and he's the COO of the app at the time that I interviewed him in 2016 for the documentary that I did called Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age. And he spoke, you know, very openly and almost proudly about the fact that it was very addictive.
We have 1.5 billion swipes a day. And I know a long time ago in the early days, I think I had figured out if the average swipe or something was, I don't know, like an inch or something. I can't remember how many times you could wrap around the earth with the number of swipes. And that was a long time ago. So I'm, you know, we might be on our way to Mars now or something. I'm not sure.
And that they designed it to be addictive based on this principle in psychology related to the work of B.F. Skinner, the controversial psychologist from, he's known for a lot of work that he did in the 60s and 70s. And one of the things that he did was an experiment whereby pigeons become addicted to a game in which they peck for food. And when they don't know when they will get their food, they get more interested and they peck, 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 peck. And, oh, I got food, peck, peck, peck. And then eventually they're just pecking to play the game. And that's like pigeon Tinder, because people are just swiping because they get addicted to that dopamine rush of getting your pellet of food, which is a match. And the screen lights up and it's, oh, you got a match. And your brain shoots, your pituitary gland shoots out this little squirt of dopamine, which makes you feel good for a few seconds or a second. And that's a little jolt. And Jonathan Bedeen, in the interview that I did with him, he actually described it as a, quote, nice little rush. You know, so it's like drugs, right? And so
sure.
I did get addicted, but that's really no different from anyone who uses the app. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make. You might not even notice that you are or realize that you are, but what do you call it when you are swiping on an app hours a day or at least hours a week? I mean, one survey said that people ages 18 to 35 swipe on dating apps up to 10 hours a week. And I'm sure I did that much, if not more. I mean, 10 hours a week is a lot of time.
It is. There's also kind of this sinister appeal to dating apps, isn't there?
I think one of the biggest concerns is that it's a bad faith proposition in terms of the companies. The companies, what they're marketing to people is different from what the apps are doing to people who use them. And they know this. I mean, they're the ones who designed them. They know what's going on. They designed them pointedly to have certain effects on people. And they do lots and lots of studies and data of their own. So they know what's going on. And what they say is going to happen is different from what they know happens. And what they say is going to happen is that you're going to find the love of your life. You're going to have a wonderful experience. You're going to experience the ability to find people who are good people. What actually happens for a lot of people is really quite different. The experience of using dating apps is not fun and does not make people's lives better. And we know that the majority of women on dating apps will see an unsolicited nude image. And that sounds like something, you know, that's like something that women have already been conditioned to be accepting of as part of dating. But it's outrageous, and it's actually a crime in many places, you know. So there's a huge problem with dating apps and sexual assault that is so under discussed. This is this weird, undiscussed reality that women and others who use these apps are experiencing that I wanted to write about, I wanted to talk about, because I also experienced it. And it was so at odds with what I was being told, we were being told this experience was going to be like.
Yeah, which makes me think of you asking the question, is the goal of dating apps really to help us find relationships, or is it to get us to have a relationship with the app itself? What do you think the answer is?
Oh, I think it's clearly the latter. That's the business model, right? That's another part of the bad faith proposition, is like they say that their intention is to find you love or at least a companion of some kind. But the actual business model is to get you to engage perpetually and as often as possible with the app itself. Use and usage is what drives these companies and all of social media, actually. The numbers, they need to get more and more and more and more numbers, which leaves less time for actually meeting people, talking to people, engaging with people in person.
In 2016, you started shooting your documentary for HBO, Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age. And you say that while you were making this doc, you were simultaneously learning about yourself and your own behavior on dating apps. Can you give us an example?
Well, yeah, it was a really interesting experience because I'd never really done any kind of reporting before where I was experiencing the same things as the people that I was interviewing. You know what I mean? It's like you sit down and here's a 21, 22-year-old young woman or young man in front of you talking about things that they were happening to them. And the same things were happening to me, and I was in my early 50s.
I'm very aware of the sort of pressure and the need to like be manicured and like beautiful and have like a uniform Instagram feed that people will want to follow and pay attention to. I'm constantly haunted by FOMO. I can easily fall into rabbit holes where I'll spend hours just like scrolling through blogs that have these pictures of like beautiful, beautiful women that I'm never gonna be, and like these houses and these clothes and these vacations that I'm never gonna have. I don't have the greatest self-esteem, which is something I've been trying to work on, which is another reason why I've been trying to sort of like step back from spending so much time online.
And that's really why I would seek them out to talk about this stuff, because a lot of it was kind of upsetting. Like you had to talk to somebody about it.
Yeah, definitely. Very well said. I was very struck by your statement that the very design of dating apps can reinforce biases or sexual racism. Can you explain that?
Yeah. This isn't talked about nearly enough. It's not that no one's reported on it. It's just it doesn't become part of the major conversation about dating apps, and it absolutely should, which is that there's a lot of racism on dating apps.
Yeah. No, like they never seen a black woman before.
They say no blacks, no fats, no like, yeah. Just like that. Like, it's exactly like that. If you're chubby, they be like,
whole different side
no
of
fat women, no blacks, no Latinos, only white, only 18.
There's a few aspects to this. One involves the algorithms, and one just involves the failure of the dating app companies to monitor the apps. And the latter is that a person of color can go on a dating app and see in the profile of someone who might come up in their feed something racist. People also are ableist on these apps, and they are fat shaming. So that's the non-algorithmic way that this goes down. But the algorithmic way that it happens is that the algorithms are your matchmaker. What the algorithms do is if you swipe on certain people, like they show you more people like that. They tend to reinforce racism, racial preferences in dating, which I think is just another form of racism. It's just like a nice way of saying racism. It's still keeping certain people talking to certain people. It's still like a Jim Crow kind of algorithm that says that these people should date each other here and these people should date each other over here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not good at all, what you've just told us. That's something that shouldn't be happening. What do you think is the biggest problem with online dating?
The biggest problem is that it's not safe. And yet, it's become somehow something people agree to put up with. And I don't think we should agree to put up with it, because there's so much that the dating apps can do to change that. I mean, they should vet people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many other things they can do, but start with that.
How do you think dating apps will evolve?
They won't evolve until they have to. There are a couple of congressional investigations. There's one into age checks. That dating apps do not have age checks. It started before COVID, and I don't know the status of it right now. They're going to have to do age checks at a certain point. I mean, there are like children hooking up with adults and being sexually assaulted, and this isn't some kind of overblown myth. You can Google it. And they're also having a problem with grown-ups being sexually assaulted and raped. So they need to change. They have to change. I don't think they're going to change until there's real pressure on them to change. I really think that politicians have to get involved. There needs to be a serious investigation of this industry, and politicians need to act to protect users, because the dating apps will not do it.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right about that. Nancy Jo Sales, thank you very much. It was great talking to you. Congratulations on your book and your documentary.
Thank you so much.
Nancy Jo Sales is the author of Nothing Personal, My Secret Life in the Dating App Inferno. She's also the director, producer, and writer of the documentary film Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age. You can find out more about Nancy and dating apps at wpr.org/beta.
There can be so much pain and shame and guilt and all that stuff attached to mental stuff that it can bear down very hard, and it did on me.
Comedian, TV writer, and radio host Tom Sharpling joins us to talk very candidly about being funny while struggling with mental illness. And we'll take a look at the career of cult filmmaker Jim Jarmusch. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Tom Sharpling has hosted the popular radio show The Best Show with Tom Sharpling for 18 years. His fans include John Oliver, Mark Maron, and Patton Oswalt. He also served as executive producer and writer for the TV series Monk, starring Green Bay's own Tony Shalhoub as a detective dealing with obsessive-compulsive disorder. But despite his uncanny ability to make people laugh, Tom Sharpling has dealt with mental illness for most of his life. He opens up about his battles with depression, guilt, and shame in a candid memoir called It Never Ends, a memoir with nice memories. Tom is able to find the good in his life and encourages readers to do the same. One of his book's many revelations is that Tom Sharpling's name isn't really Tom Sharpling. It's Tom Giuliano. So why did he change his last name to Sharpling?
It was just kind of a mishmash of some people I liked. Gary Shandling, Al Sharpton, Mel Sharples from Alice. It was just a little bit of everything thrown in there. Mushed them all together and came up with Sharpling.
Did changing your name have the goal that you wanted of changing the way you thought about yourself, your self-image?
I mean, it was still me. It just gave me a chance to be me, if anything, like to be the actual person, not still live in the past with some inherited baggage. It really was a way to just move forward.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by be yourself? Like, what was different about your behavior and the way you thought once you changed your name?
I don't know. I mean, I was just trying to do whatever I could to get by. This is not like, there was not really some master plan with any of this. It's just you do little things and then you turn around and a lot of time has gone by and that's where you ended up.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I've got to ask you about your Patti Smith experience. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I was just in San Francisco for the San Francisco Sketch Fest, and my partner, John Worster, comedy partner, John Worster, and I were in the lobby of the hotel, and we kept seeing Patti Smith over and over. And then finally, I was, she was clearly staying at the same hotel for a couple days. So by the fourth time, I was like, I want to just say something to her. And she got into the elevator. I got into the, I followed her in and I said, hey, how are your shows going over at the Fillmore? And she was like, oh, they're good. And then I said, well, then I was trying to come up with something interesting that I could say that wouldn't just be the run of the mill questions she gets asked. And so I asked her if she ever saw Humble Pie back in the day, is how I phrased it, which is not exactly how I talk, but I don't know why I said it that way, but I did. And she immediately was not into it. And yeah, I totally ate it in that moment. And it was pretty bleak. And I think she got off at a floor that wasn't her floor, perhaps, just to get away from the guy talking about Humble Pie. Yeah, it was one of the many dumb things that's happened to me.
Mm. You're probably best known for your very popular radio program, The Best Show, with Tom Sharpling. Can you tell us a bit about the show and what you get out of doing it?
Yeah, it's a weekly call-in comedy show, and it's just the most satisfying thing I've been a part of creatively. It's a fun space to work within, to just be able to fill it up however I want. I get to do stuff with John Worster every week and take calls and just go wherever it goes. It's very, very liberating to have a creative platform that can just take on whatever shape I want it to take on.
Guy Noir, which apparently is some, that's like a one of these Garrison Keebler routines that he does. I think it's like a detective thing where it's like,
it's me, I'm gonna portray a Guy Noir now, and there was a murder at Lake Wobegon. Four dead bodies were found in the sitting room of Mrs. Dalrymple.
You worked as a writer on the TV series Monk, which starred Green Bay's own Tony Shalhoub as a detective with an extreme case of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was great. It was getting to write on a television show is always amazing. And this one in particular was just so much. Again, we just had so much room to try different things and to have fun with it. And Tony's just the best. So he made it all possible.
Yeah. Can you give me an example of just how he was the best, how he was so great to work with?
He's just game for just about anything. He really respected the writers and gave us chances to try stuff and would try to bring anything we would come up with to life and see what was possible. And that really just encourages a very positive, creative atmosphere.
Adrian, take off your sunglasses.
Why?
You look like a drug dealer.
No, I don't.
I'm telling you, you do. You fit the profile perfectly. You have 18 suitcases and you're wearing a suit. I mean, if you were a cop, wouldn't you think you look suspicious?
Buenos dias. How long will you be in Mexico?
2 to 3 days.
I'm not a drug dealer.
Pardon me?
I'm not a drug dealer.
Uh-huh. I want you to park over there and meet me inside.
Do you have a proudest accomplishment, an episode that you did most of the writing on Monk that you're most proud of?
You know, it's so funny. It's like I it was a show that I tracked every part of everything for 8 years. And then, like, I think about it now and I just, like, I worked on all of it. I was not alone working on it, obviously. Andy Breckman created the show. He was the one driving the bus with it. But it's like, I just was there the whole time, and I just pitched in on all of it. Writing a TV show is a relatively, it's a funny concept because it's ultimately, there's so many people pitching in. It's not like the kind of thing where you write a script and you hand it in and then they go film it. It goes through so many people. And sometimes I would be the one helping rewrite a thing and trying to heighten things or improve things. And sometimes I'd be the one who wrote the basic script and then other people pitched in on it. TV writing is so collaborative. It's like working on one huge episode that's 125 hours long.
Right. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. How difficult was it for you to write this book, to revisit all these, the painful memories that you could remember and you know, the depression and sadness?
Yeah, it was pretty hard. It was very hard. It was just a real challenge to have to write about things that would not come naturally to write about, and to have to put some of these things onto paper and try to make them honest and authentic, and also being funny too the whole time. It was a real tightrope.
Yeah, and you walked it very well. You walked it masterfully, I would say. Thank you. As it says on the cover of the book, a memoir with nice memories, which is true, but it also has some not so nice memories. And I think you did a really good job of finding a balance. And even though there's a lot of dark content overall, the book ends, and there's a lot of laughs throughout, and the book ends on an optimistic note.
Thank you.
In the final chapter of It Never Ends, you write, quote, "This is not a book about writing a book, but rather a book about the hurdles I needed to overcome to realize who I actually am," unquote. I was really struck by that sentence. And it leads me to this question. Do you now realize who you actually are? Has it changed? You know, has writing this book changed the way you view yourself?
I don't know if it's changed me, but it's definitely given me some perspective on myself. It's hard to say. It's really because it's happening in real time. It's like I wrote the book, and then 1 minute after I wrote that sentence, I mean, I was back into the real world again. And it's not always easy to be so incredibly self-reflective about things in the moment. So it was a special thing to have an opportunity to take a step back and look at the whole of my life and get to see the patterns and the things I did over and over, or the things I tried to stop doing. I'm sure that'll just change me going forward, having that perspective on things. But it's like I'm in a car going 100 miles an hour, and I'm also reflecting on being in a car going 100 miles an hour, trying not to crash the car, but I'm observing that I'm in the car.
Yeah. Thanks for that. You described that very well. Tom Sharpling, thank you very much. It was so great to talk to you. Congratulations again on It Never Ends.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking the time.
Tom Sharpling is a comedian, television writer, and radio host, and the author of It Never Ends, a memoir with nice memories. Find a nice article about Tom at WPR.org/beta.
I'm the dude.
These guys are 11.
This is a tasty burger.
Inconceivable!
Just a flesh wound.
All right, all right, all right.
That action-packed audio logo means it's time for a new feature on Beta. Cult Filmmakers with Ian Hayden Smith. Ian is the author of, wait for it, Cult Filmmakers. That's some great synergy, isn't it? Today, Ian talks about one of our favorites, Jim Jarmusch. From Permanent Vacation through Patterson, Jim Jarmusch's films have always been positively his own. As Ian breaks down here, there are no limits of his control.
Well, he's probably the godfather of the modern indie movie. I know people say that the indie film scene, as opposed to independent cinema, that the indie with a capital I sort of began in the late 80s, early 90s. Many people see it as being heralded by Steven Soderbergh and Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival in 1989. I'd say let's jump back 5 years to Jim Jarmusch's second film, Stranger Than Paradise. The thing about Jim Jarmusch, he's incredibly cool. Both in person, when he's talking about his career or his life, or the people he loves, the music, the musicians, the novelists, the filmmakers. But also in his films, they just give off this wonderful coolness. The characters are very nonchalant. But at the same time, I think what's interesting about Jarmusch is that his films and his own persona have created this aura of someone who exists just outside the mainstream. His characters, I mean, look at the characters in Stranger Than Paradise. They're sort of loners who get together for a road trip. You know it's not going to end particularly well. Each of them are idiosyncratic characters, but they are singular characters. They're not cliches in any way whatsoever. And they're not quirky characters. They are fully rounded human beings But they're just like all of us. You scratch beneath the surface, and actually, we're all a little bit strange at heart. And I think that's what Jarmusch minds.
How did you guys find me here?
We went to Aramati's house, and she told us that you were here.
Oh, you already saw her, huh? So can you stay for a few days?
Yeah, we could. Why not? I don't know.
Oh, I'm so happy to see you. You want a hot dog?
No.
You already ate, right?
Yeah.
So I have a little more work to do, like 20 minutes. Can you wait for me?
Yeah, we came to pick you up.
It's also really interesting that you look at a lot of directors' careers, and they tend to start out in genre a lot of the time and then develop into building their own voice. And Jarmusch, to a certain degree, has kind of jumped the other way around. He's working the other way around, because Permanent Vacation, his first film, which was set in New York, came out of the no wave group of artists that existed in New York in the late 70s into the 80s. And it's kind of post-punk as well. It's got this real punkish attitude. But it's just a great character piece. Likewise, Stranger Than Paradise. It's a really good character study. And then his wonderful Down by Law, which again is another brilliant character study, this time of three guys who are up on minor charges in a prison cell just outside New Orleans. You've got John Lurie, who was also one of the great jazz punk musicians and formed the band Lounge Lizards. You've got the truly great Tom Waits, and also the Italian actor Roberto Benigni, who would go on to great fame and Oscar success with Life is Beautiful. And these guys escape from prison and go on the run in the backwaters outside of New Orleans.
We'll find something.
Yeah, he's leading us the wrong way.
Who, Bob? He ain't leading us.
Hey, man. You don't think I see what's going on?
If you move on a decade and away from these character pieces, first of all, you get an alternate Western, a black and white Western, Dead Man, starring Johnny Depp, which I would argue is probably Jim Jarmusch's finest film. It really is an astonishing, formally brilliant piece of filmmaking with a stunning score by Neil Young.
You're William Blake.
Yes, I am.
By the grace of the Lord Almighty. So, would it be presumptuous of me to ask you for your autograph?
Then you go on to a samurai film, Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, with Forrest Whitaker taking on New York's Italian mafia.
He said Ghost Dog.
Yeah, he calls himself Ghost Dog. I don't know, a lot of these black guys today, these gangster type guys, they all got names like that they make up for themselves.
Is that true?
Sure. He means like the rappers. You know, the rappers, they all got names like that. Snoop Doggy Dogg, Ice Cube, Q-Tip, Method Man. My favorite was always Flavor Flav from Public Enemy. He got the funky fresh fly flavor. Live lyrics from the bank of reality. I kick the flies to maneuver technicality. Do a dope track. I love that guy.
I don't know anything about that.
Then jump forward a few years. You've got a vampire film with Only Lovers Left Alive with Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton, who, let's face it, is the perfect vampire.
That's delicious.
Blood on a stick.
On a stick.
That's not bad.
Very refreshing, especially when you're in a hot spot.
And then jump forward a couple more years, and to last year, you've got The Dead Don't Die, which is a zombie movie.
They're just dead people.
Well, yeah, for now, they're still just dead hipsters, but they haven't turned yet. It can take a while.
He's right, Mindy. Now they're just dead hipsters from Cleveland.
And so a lot of people started off making these genre films, but Jarmusch decided to, along the way, start picking up his various genres that he would play with. And each time he plays with them brilliantly. He's constantly subverting expectations. And I think Dead Man, more than any other, rather than being this rural Western, it's a Western set in industrial times. I mean, Jarmusch plays brilliantly with that film and the Western genre, and he would continue to go on doing that. But at the same time, he still makes these lovely offbeat character studies, such as Patterson with Adam Driver as a postman. And it's a really, really beautiful film. But they're like nothing else. there aren't films that are Jarmusch-esque, because I think he's so singular that I think anyone who's tried to copy him, it just never gets it right.
That was Ian Haydn Smith on the one and only Jim Jarmusch. Ian is the author of Cult Filmmakers, 50 Movie Mavericks You Need to Know. Stay tuned for another installment of Cult Filmmakers coming your way on Beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Glenn Frankel, Nancy Jo Sales, Tom Sharpling, and Ian Haydn Smith. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes that make long drives and housework more bearable, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He ain't much of a stud either, from what I hear.
Our executive producer is Adam Frieder.
You know, with proper management, you could be taking home $50, maybe $100 a day, easy.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I know enough to know that that great big dumb cowboy crap of yours don't appeal to nobody.